give thanks and praise to God, who alone is worthy of all glory, honor, and praise. It is a privilege and an honor to be here before you today. I give thanks to Pastor Troy and Minister Troy in their absence, and for their capable leadership that guides us as a community together. I do believe there is a word from the Lord on today, and I don't want to spend any unnecessary time. I'll try. I prefer to take the time that is due and not the time that I could, because I respect your time and your feelings, your emotions. People who show up for 7:30 service, you know, are people of habit, people of consistency. And I believe in rewarding that consistency with respect for your time. So with your prayers and God's help, I will endeavor to share what I believe the Lord has given to me for today. So if you will, look with me to the book of Isaiah, the 35th chapter, verses 1 through 10. It's Isaiah chapter 35, verses 1 through 10. And I'll be reading from the New Revised Standard Version. And the passage reads as follows. The wilderness and the dry land shall be glad. The desert shall rejoice and blossom like the crocus. It shall blossom abundantly and rejoice with joy and singing. The glory of Lebanon shall be given to it, the majesty of Carmel and Sharon. They shall see the glory of the Lord, the majesty of our God. Strengthen the weak hands and make firm the feeble knees. Say to those who are of a fearful heart, be strong, do not fear. Here is your God. He will come with vengeance, with terrible recompense. He will come and save you. Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then the lame shall leap like a deer and the tongue of the speechless sing for joy. For water shall break forth in the wilderness and streams in the desert. The burning sand shall become a pool and the thirsty ground springs of water. The haunt of jackals shall become a swamp. The grass shall become reeds and rushes. A highway shall be there, and it shall be called the Holy Way. The unclean shall not travel on it, but it shall be for God's people. No traveler, not even fools, shall go astray. No lion shall be there, nor shall any ravenous beast come up on it. They shall not be found there, but the redeemed shall walk there. And the ransomed of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with singing. Everlasting joy shall be upon their heads. They shall obtain joy and gladness, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. I want to reflect for a few moments on this idea. Wait until next season. Wait until next season. Now, I spent 12 years of my life living in the northeastern United States in the area that is known as New England. And the state of Connecticut is very beautiful, but it's brutal in the winter. Now, my last winter there, this was winter in 2011 going into 2012. We had one of the worst winters in memory. Overnight, we got 2 feet of snow. So I woke up the next morning, imagining that I was going to head to my 9 o'clock class, and opened my door to find that I could barely budge it open because the snow was up to my knees. It took me 2 hours to shovel my walkway and my driveway. I was not happy. It was a Thursday morning. Exactly 1 week later, we got another snowstorm. 2 more feet of snow. And it was at this point that I decided I was done with winter. I was done with the Northeast. I was done with snow. Because when you wake up and see that much snow on your doorstep, before you do anything else for the rest of your day, to know that I've got to put on my winter coat and get my gloves and my hat and my scarf and my boots and do physical labor for a couple of hours before I start the rest of my day. It does something to you mentally, does something to you emotionally. You feel some kind of way, and at some point you've had enough. But I got off easy because for some people, the winter hits a little harder. There's what we call seasonal affective disorder, a particular kind of depression that impacts people because the weather has changed, because the seasons have changed. And people tend to suffer from it around the same time every year. Now, it doesn't take a psychologist to recognize that when seasons change, people go through changes too. The sun rises a little later and it sets earlier, and suddenly getting out of bed feels a little bit harder. Darkness in the sky starts to mirror the darkness in our own minds. It gets so cold outside that we isolate ourselves in our homes, and our hearts grow cold too. The changing of the seasons can be rough, and the holiday season can be another layer on top of that. Not just because it's cold and dark, but because some people don't have something to celebrate. Some people are struggling because they're mourning. For some people, it's the first holiday without that loved one. For other people, they're far from home and estranged from their families. Other people are dealing with hardship on the holidays, and there is no reason to celebrate. Now, we know the calendar changes and we know that the holidays end, but the seasons of our lives are not so predictable. Now, what happens when your mind and your spirit have been stuck in the same season over and over again? There's no growth and there's no change. We become stagnant and we struggle to find meaning and purpose. And whenever I feel stuck, I take myself back to those winter days in Connecticut and I remind myself that the toughest winters of my life have all ended at some point. Winter doesn't mean that everything is dead. It means that many things are dormant. They're sleeping, they're still, they're underground, they're under the snow, they're undercover. And if I can just wait and make it till next season, new life is possible. Isaiah 35 is a preview of the next season. It's a preview that prepares us for what is coming. We can see what's ahead even though it's not here yet. And the language of Isaiah 35 is future tense. It's speaking to things that have not happened yet, but things that are on the way. And it's important to remember this because the audience of Isaiah 35 is not us. It's people who understand what it means to deal with unpredictable seasons of their lives. People who depend on the land and on the weather for their survival. Now, as far as I know, no one in here is a full-time farmer. If you are, I stand corrected. But if you are a farmer, Your dependency on land and weather is different from other folks. If you get up in the morning to go to a factory to make widgets and nuts and bolts, you can do that regardless of the weather. If you're a farmer, you need ideal conditions. You need to know when to plant and when to harvest. If you're a farmer, you need to understand how the unpredictability of the weather can impact your crops. And what we know about ancient Israel is that the Israelites were agrarian people. They were farmers, people who lived off of the land. And the climate in and around ancient Israel was not like our climate. Their climate was a place where they had rainy seasons and dry seasons. So what we call winter would have been their rainy season, and what we call summer would have been their dry season. Now, why does this matter? Because they depended on the weather for their crops. And there was always a chance, because the weather was unpredictable, that there would not be enough rain to saturate the ground to enable their crops to grow. Now, for some of us, if there's a bad crop year, that just means you won't buy strawberries this week. For a farmer, a bad crop is the difference between prosperity and poverty. People who lived off the land understood that if you had too many years of failed crops in a row, it could lead to debt. In their time, you might have to sell some of your family members into slavery. You might even get to the end of your family line because you can no longer survive off the land that you have. These are the stakes of the land and the weather and the seasons for the people who are being addressed in Isaiah 35. So it's written to people who have had seasons of enslavement and exile, people who survived the Exodus. If we read through the Hebrew Bible, we start to understand that the Israelite people have been through some stuff. They've been through some traumas. They carry the effect and impact of those things from generation to generation. And it's important to always have a recognition, a memory, remembrance of what we've been through and what our ancestors have been through, but it's just as important to renegotiate our relationship to those memories. Because many times it's not just a matter of inheriting the trauma of the people before us. Sometimes it is we get stuck in the trauma and don't know how to imagine another way of living. Every generational curse is not really a generational curse. It might just be you keep choosing to do things that no longer serve you. We live into family habits. We are taught how to live and how to be by our family systems. And what I've come to understand about family systems is everyone's family is dysfunctional in their own way. And that's not your fault. But the life you live as a result of it is your responsibility. And that can be hard to hear because for legitimate reasons, we might hold on to grudges and hold on to hurt, hold on to unforgiveness because there are things that have not been corrected, things that have not been made right, things that have not been restored. And it's fine to feel some type of way about the seasons of life you've experienced. But what I can tell you is that no one is going to pull you out of that season unless you are prepared to operate differently. Unless you're prepared to choose differently. There are some things we inherited and there's nothing we can do about it, but we don't have to keep paying a bad inheritance forward to every other generation. These are people who have been stuck. People who have histories of survival and success, but they keep getting stuck in the same patterns over and over again. They know what it's like to be stuck in a season and want life to be different. But what does the author give us here? The author gives us a promise of restoration. The prophet Isaiah is speaking in a language that the people can understand. And what language is that? You have to know the people you're dealing with. So people who have a relationship with the land, who live off the land, understand that you have to be attentive to the patterns of nature around you. There are things we might overlook that offer evidence to people who know how to live off the land. And I believe that it's no mistake that the author gives us language that turns our attention to the natural world. I ask myself, what does it mean for a wilderness and a dry land to rejoice and be glad? Well, if we know anything about dry lands and wilderness, we know those are not places where things can easily live and survive. Now, there are plants and animals that make it in the desert, but that's because they have adapted to harsh conditions. The conditions don't get better. The living things simply adapt. And there's a lesson here for us that sometimes circumstances don't change. Sometimes the only thing that can change is my response to the circumstance. It's not meant to be hopeless. In fact, it's meant to be a reminder that we can do something differently. I'm not saying it's easy to choose differently. Habits are habits for a reason. They're easy. They're automatic. But we're being invited through the text to choose something different. We're being invited to see that the circumstances just might change if our perspective on them can change. And so rejoicing comes in the desert. The wilderness and the dry land become personified. They are rejoicing. Why? Because circumstances have changed. Suddenly flowers are blooming where there was once just dry sand. And I don't think it's an accident that the author mentions a specific flower, the crocus. Now, I don't know everything about plants. I don't exactly have a green thumb, but I do know how to read and research. And what I learned in my reading and research is that the crocus is a very particular kind of plant. It has bright and bold colors. It stands out when you see it. It's definitely going to stand out against a desert backdrop. If a bright flower starts growing in the middle of the desert, it's hard not to see it. But what else do we know about the crocus? Well, the crocus blooms in late winter. It doesn't wait until springtime to emerge from the ground. It comes out in late winter. What does that tell me? Well, it tells me it's been alive the whole winter. But it also tells me it is not waiting for seasons to change in order to show signs of life. Spring is coming even though the weather hasn't broken. And the flower has got sense enough to know I'm still alive even if the weather hasn't changed. It's the difference between simply, I put it this way, you when I drive to New Salem from my home, I live way out in the northern tundra out in Delaware, and when I drive here, I don't have to think about where I'm going. I know exactly how to get here. I go down US 23 and I hop on 270 to 71, get off at Weber. I know the way and I don't have to think about it. When I first drove there, I needed to put it in the GPS because I needed to be sure, all right, let me make sure I get off at the right stop and am I in the right lane? There are all these things to think about, and after a while, it just becomes a habit. It becomes like second nature. There are things that I no longer have to think about. Why? Because I know the way and no longer need the signs. The crocus is a reminder that when you know the way to your next season, you don't need things around you to tell you it's coming. The crocus blooms because it knows it is time, not because the circumstances are ideal. No one has to give instructions to tell the crocus what to do. It does what it does because that's what it's designed for, what it's made for. It's hardwired. It doesn't have to think about whether conditions are ideal or am I getting off at the right exit. No, the crocus knows exactly where it's going and what it needs to do. And it is going where? Up through the ground, through the snow. It is breaking out in a way that suggests restoration is coming. But what else do we know about the crocus? And this is important. The crocus grows year after year, and it spreads as it grows. That means one crocus produces more crocus plants. It means that even when it gets to the end of its cycle in one season, it comes back in the next season. It does not die just because winter comes. It waits until it can grow again. And this brings me back to this idea of seasonal affective disorder. The crocus is not impacted or affected by the seasons. It doesn't dictate its action by the season it's in, but by the purpose it has. And the difficulty about seasonal affective disorder is not that you are unable to do the things you normally can, but that mentally and emotionally, we are unable to activate what we're already able to do. You're physically able to get out of the bed, but your emotions won't let you. We become paralyzed by fear, not because our bodies don't operate as normal, but because our minds and our hearts are stuck. I want to suggest to you that the children of Israel have seasonal affective disorder. That they are stuck precisely because they can't imagine or see something past the trauma they've lived through. All they know is the difficult parts of their history, and so trying to break out, trying to imagine another season seems almost impossible. Now, how do we know this? Well, I think we know this because of the way the author speaks to their condition. The author speaks words of encouragement to the people, telling them to what? Strengthen your weak knees. And strengthen your weak hands and strengthen your fearful hearts. Now, if my hands are weak, that means I can't lift, I can't build, I can't latch on to anything. If my knees are weak, I can't stand. I can't run, I can't move well. If my heart is weak, I'm not able to love, I'm not able to trust. And I believe the author is not speaking in literal terms, but speaking in metaphorical terms, that something happens to us when the season has effectively brought us to a standstill. When we're unable to think or to imagine beyond the place that we're in. I believe I'm speaking to somebody today who has been stuck. Not for a day, not for a week, not for a month, maybe even not for a year, maybe for a lifetime. All right. Been stuck in the model, in the mindset somebody told you had to live by. Somebody has told you, you're gonna be just like your daddy. You're gonna be just like your mama. They wasn't no good and you ain't no good either. Family systems, family patterns, expectations that get thrust upon us, and we don't know how to live any other way because this is all we've ever known. But the author speaks to the need to strengthen our knees and to strengthen our hands and to strengthen our hearts. In other words, we can't move forward unless we are well, unless we are whole. And I'm reminded that these are the kinds of things that happen when you've been in exile. The people of Israel have gone through enslavement. They have gone through exile. They have been displaced from their homes and from their lands. And if you are people who depend on the land and someone takes your land from you, who are you without your land? Who are you without your holy places? What happens to your memories when you can't go back home? I know a lot of us like to go to our school homecomings, and we like to go to these events, and we get nostalgic because we remember what it was like back when. Homecoming is hard to do when there's no home to go to. And the children of Israel are in that space. They have had to deal with not having a home to go back to and wondering what is next for us on the other side of this. And their state of spiritual depression keeps them from seeing that something else is possible. That another world is on the way and is already here if they can just turn their attention to it. But I'm glad the author gives a possibility of transformation. Transformation starts with the belief that the world can be different. Some people will never achieve the goals and the dreams they have in mind because they can't imagine themselves achieving it. Some people will only go exactly as far as they believe they can. Now, I'm not saying every goal or dream we have is realistic. I might dream of playing in the NBA, but guess what? I'm only 5'8", and I'm in my mid-30s. It's not going to happen. There are some things we're just not gifted to do. Some things are not going to happen for us, but there are things that can happen that God can do for us and through us, but our belief has to be transformed. And I see the author putting this mindset in play, that there's a transformation of perspective. That those who were blind will now be able to see, that those who could not hear are now able to hear. Those who couldn't walk can now stand up and move, and those who couldn't talk are now able to have speech. Transformation of our perspective leads to a transformation of our performance. We do things differently when we believe we can, when we have confidence that God can and will do something through us. And when our perspective has been transformed and our performance has been transformed, suddenly we find that the pathway has been transformed. The pathway in the text doesn't arise until the people have been made whole. There's no point in a pathway if you can't move. And the pathway here in the text is one that God has given for God's people. A pathway where only the righteous can walk. I believe there are some ways you can move through life because God has equipped and blessed you in ways that others might not be. I believe there are some pathways I've been able to walk only because I was obedient to God and I couldn't have bust that door open with my gifts and talents. The text doesn't say the gifted and talented will walk this way. It says the righteous will walk this way. Righteousness is not simply about being right or being pious or being holy. It's also about being just. It's about being in good relationship with people. It's about understanding that who we are meant to be together is greater than who we are apart. And the text is a reminder that, yes, there will be a home to return to. Yes, this is not the end season of your life. And I know it's difficult right now, but things can and will change. I tell you, the lessons I learned living in Connecticut were valuable for my life. But the start of my journey was the most difficult. I was 17 years old. I left my home in Detroit to go live in New Haven, Connecticut to start as a freshman at Yale University. And here's the thing. People celebrate when you go off to school. What they don't see is the cultural and spiritual exile that happens once you leave. Now, I was a black kid from a very black home in a very black city went to a very black church, very black schools, all black everything. But I also was one of seven kids, grew up in a single parent home, dealt with living below the poverty line, and went to a place where suddenly I saw 12 of my classmates were all from the same prep school. Living in a place where I started to realize how power and wealth and inequality really work in this world. Living in a place where nobody cared that I grew up Church of God in Christ and if they believed in anything at all. And suddenly, I realized I am in cultural exile. I'm trying to figure out how to survive in a place, in a season, in a place that is cold towards who I am. In a place that is indifferent to my history. In a place where folk don't know my background and don't care because they've already decided who I am and where I can go and what I can be on the basis of what they've observed. So what did I do in this season? Well, I'll tell you the truth. For undergrad, I was pretty much functionally depressed the entire time. There were days where I would go and sit in the common room in my dorm and watch TV for hours because I couldn't bring myself to do the stuff I knew how to do. I knew how to study, but sometimes emotionally, it just wasn't there. And I realized only in retrospect that this is what happens when you get stuck in your seasonal affective disorder. When the season of your life has transformed your belief and perspective about who you are and what you can do. But the prophet Isaiah has told us this, that in the midst of our exile, in the midst of our difficulty, there is an escape. There is a pathway. There is a possibility for life that doesn't have to be a repeat of what we've always known. And I give thanks to God for even the difficult seasons. Because the difficult seasons, the long winters, taught me that at the end I was still alive. Winter disturbed me. And winter depressed me. It did not destroy me. And so we are here today. Because the winter seasons of our life have not destroyed us. They have taught us that we are survivors, that we are strong, that we are capable, that trusting in the God who has delivered us time and time again pays off. So I'm promising you, if you can wait until next season, if you can see the blooming of life in your life even now, you don't have to wait until springtime to know that God is still alive and that God is still building us up, no matter what season of your life it is. God bless you.